tea," she muttered. She turned around. Her face marked her as being of middle years, dotted with freckles and pock scars. Her chin was narrow and pointed like a shovel, and her smile was missing several teeth. "The rules here are simple. Do what Madam says. You know where the tea water pump is. You'll go up there every day. You'll go with me to market when I need you to. Don't go north of Chamber Street or wandering off past Mulberry, lest Madam writes you a pass. You don't want folks thinking you're trying to run. That don't work here. You been a housemaid before?" I shook my head. "We lived on a farm." "Pardon me, ma'am. Miss Becky, but can you tell me where my sister is?"
"Your what?"
Her eyebrows went up. "Ooh, that little girl?" I nodded. "Ruth. She's slow, ain't she?" I didn't dare explain till I figured what kind of person Becky was. "She's good-natured." Becky walked into a pantry crowded with shelves of crockery. "That gonna cause me trouble." "Never," I lied. "Where is she, please, ma'am?" Becky came out carrying a tarnished silver teapot and a stack of china cups and plates. "Madam Loxton told me to give the little one a bath and feed her." She went back to the pantry and shouted a little so I could hear her. "She's in the privy. Your sister, I mean, not the madam." I let out a long breath and stepped toward the door. Becky came back carrying a small chest. "Where do you think you're going?" "To fetch Ruth." "Oh, no, you're not," Becky said. "Madam wants her outside peeling potatoes. You're to work in here." "But..." Through the window, I watched Ruth leave the privy and walk straight to a bench. She hopped up on it, pulled a potato from the sack next to her, and started peeling with a small knife, her feet kicking in the air under the bench. She looked like a little bird on a twig. I relaxed some. She was safe and happy enough. Becky brushed at the cobwebs clinging to her skirt. "But nothing. If Madam sees you idling and jawing out there, there'll be the devil to pay." She paused. "She can be a harsh mistress to slaves." I waited for her to say more, but she shook her head once and handed me a broom. "Me, I see things different." She picked up a pile of rags in a jar. "You do what you're told and we'll get along fine. Now follow me and pay attention." Becky led me down a narrow corridor to the front entry hall, where a grand staircase curled upward. A tall grandfather clock sat at the foot of the stairs, pecking away at the hour as if a crow trapped inside were trying to break loose. The walnut linen chest that Madam had fussed over at the dock was set in front of the clock. Opposite the chest was the door that led to the street. Two other doors with tarnished brass pulls faced the hall. Becky pointed to the door on the right. "That there's the master's library. You don't step foot in it without permission. He don't like his things touched." "A library with books?" "And maps and papers all in a jumble. It's a wonder he can find anything." She opened the door on the left and entered, me at her heels. "This is the good parlor, where I'll serve the tea. The drawing room is upstairs. We'll clean up there later. Open them windows." The room was crowded with furniture draped with cloth. The air was thick and stale. I pulled aside the heavy drapes and stretched on my toes to push up the window. The sills were dusty, and the corners were spun thick with spider webs studded with dead flies. I went to open the next window as Becky laid out a rag on each sill. "Wipe down the windows and sweep the floor before you uncover the furniture," she said. The second window was stubborn. I pushed as hard as I could until it suddenly flew up and I near lost my balance. Becky grabbed me before I tumbled outside. "Easy on," she said as I regained my balance. "You're no good to me with a cracked head." Three soldiers wearing homespun shirts and carrying muskets walked past the window, laughing loudly. "I wish they'd all go home," Becky muttered. "Soldiers is a nuisance." "You don't like the rebels?" I asked. Becky put a finger to her lips and pulled me away from the window. "Listen to me good. Them that feeds us," she pointed upstairs, "they're loyalists, Tories. That means we're Tories too, understand?"
"Yes, ma'am," I nodded.
But I hesitated, not sure if I was allowed to ask questions. "Master Loxton claimed he was a patriot on the docks." Becky fought to open the final window. A cool breeze flowed through the room and stirred the dust. "He was faking to protect his skin. Some folks switch back and forth. One day they're for the king, the next it's all liberty and freedom. Huzzah! A tribe of Mr. Face in both ways. That's what you'll find in New York. But you know what never changes?
I shook my head. No. What?
Madam wants lemon cakes with a tea. She is terrible fond of cakes, is Madam. Lady Clarissa Seymour is coming to hear all the news from Boston.
A lady? A royal lady?
Becky laughed. Close enough. She's the master's aunt. She's rich and old and owns land in three countries. The master hopes to inherit the lot when she dies, so they treat her like the queen herself, to her face at least.
The grandfather clock in the hall bonged loudly, four times, startling us both.
Wretched clock, Becky muttered. I'm off to the baker. Finish sweeping in here and dusting. After that, polish the teapot and bring in the firewood. Don't stop moving, whatever you do.
Chapter 8. Wednesday, May 29th through Thursday, June 6, 1776. We have in common with all other men a natural right to our freedoms without being deprived of them by our fellow men. We were unjustly dragged by the cruel hand of power from our dearest friends and some of us stolen, and brought hither to be made slaves for life in a Christian land. Thus are we deprived of everything that hath a tendency to make life even tolerable. Petition for freedom from a group of slaves to Massachusetts Governor Thomas Gage, His Majesty's Council, and the House of Representatives, 25 May, 1774. The days started early in the Lockton kitchen. Since Becky lived in a boarding house on Oliver Street, it fell to me to wake first and build up the fire. She did the proper cooking, and I did near everything else, like washing pots and plates and beating eggs till my arms fell off from Madam's almond jumbles and plum cakes with icing. If not in the kitchen, I was removing colonies of spiders, polishing tables and chairs, or sweeping up a mountain of dust. I saved the cobwebs, twisting them around a rag and storing them by a pallet in the cellar. Cobwebs were handy when a person had a bloody cut. Madam complained every time she saw me. I left a streak of wax on the tabletop. I tracked in mud. I faced a china dog toward the door after I dusted it, which would cause the family's luck to run out. At the end of every scolding, I cast down my eyes and said, "Yes, madam." I kept careful track of her the same way as I used to mind the neighbor's bull when I took the milk cows out to pasture. She had not hit me again, but always seemed on the edge of it. Mostly, Madam slept late, wrote letters, and picked out melodies on a badly tuned spinet. A few times, she and her husband conversated fast and quiet about Mr. Washington and when the king's ships would arrive at the invasion. They argued fierce on Thursday night. Lockton shouted and called Madam rude names before storming out of the house, the front door crashing behind him. I vowed not to cross neither of them. Madam went to bed early that night, so we did too. Ruth snuggled next to me and fell asleep quick. I lay awake, praying hard but gaining little comfort. I was lost. I knew that we were in the cellar of a house on Wall Street, owned by the Locktons in the city of New York, but it was like looking at a knot, knowing it was a knot, but not knowing how to untie it. I had no map for this life. I lay awake and stared into the darkness. Madam called for tea in her bedchamber the next morning and sent for Ruth, who was pumping the butter churn with vigor. "Why would she need Ruth?" I asked as I wiped my sister's hands and face with a damp rag. "Why does she do anything?" Becky asked. "I'm to climb to the attic to fetch the cast-off clothing in an old trunk. Maybe she'll set the little one to rip out the stitches so the dressmaker can use the fabric. This best be the last of the day's fanciful notions. My knees don't like all this upping and downing of the stairs." Ruth stayed in Madam's chamber for hours. I spilled the fireplace ashes on the kitchen floor, then kicked over the bucket of wash water I brought in to clean up the mess. I stubbed my toe and then cut off my finger whilst peeling an old tough turnip. When I could stand it no more, I snuck out of the kitchen and tiptoed down the hall. I could hear the sound of Madam's voice from the bottom of the stairs, but not the words she was saying. I wanted to march up there and tell Ruth to come back and finish the butter. I did not. I forced myself to work. Becky took a tray of cookies and a pot of tea upstairs late in the afternoon. I pounced when she returned to the kitchen.
Is Ruth well? Why does Madam keep her?
Becky chose her words with care. Madam has taken a liking to you, Ruth, on account of her being so tiny and quiet. She sat at the kitchen table. She means to use her for a personal maid.
Pardon me?
Most of Madam's friends have a slave to split wood and carry chamber pots, like you. If Madam has a slave dressed in finery, well, that makes her more of a lady. Ruth can fan her when she's hot or stir the fire when she's cold.
I forgot myself and sat down across from Becky. She's making Ruth into a curiosity?
Becky nodded.
That's a good word for it.
I went cold with anger, then hot, then cold again. It wasn't right. It wasn't right for one body to own another or pull strings to make them jump. Why was Madam allowed to hit me or to treat Ruth like a toy?
Take care, Becky warned, pointing to my lap.
I looked down. My hands were clenched into fists so tight the cords that held my bones together could be seen. I released them.
Becky leaned across the table and spoke quiet. Don't imagine you like this much. Can't say I blame you, but don't lose your head. Madam is not afraid to beat her slaves.
I rubbed my palms together. Do they own more than us?
Half a dozen down to the Charleston place, none up in Boston. Never been to the Carolinas, so I don't know how they get along. But you need to calm yourself and heed what I'm about to tell you.
Yes, ma'am, I said stiffly.
2-3 years ago, there was another girl here, slave like you. She talked back. Madam called her surly and took to beating her regular-like. One day she beat her with a fireplace poker.
Did she die?
No, but her arm broke and didn't heal right. It withered and hung useless, so Madam sold her.
I could not hold the hot words in my mouth any longer. She best not come after me with a poker, or hurt Ruth.
Becky leaned back and studied on me a bit. You ain't never gonna say something like that again, not in my kitchen. I get paid decent here, and I won't let some girl like you get in the way of that. Wearing pretty dresses ain't gonna hurt the little one, so wipe that look off your face and fetch me some more wood. After that, Ruth's every waking moment was spent with Madam. Though we worked in the same house and slept under the same blanket, we had little time to talk. Ruth was permitted to sleep until the sun rose, went to bed when Madam retired, and rarely had to work in the kitchen or garden. I lay awake every night, heart filled with dread, recalling the dangerous offer made by the boy in the floppy red hat.
Chapter 9, Thursday, June 6, 1776. Hundreds in this New York colony are active against us, and such is the weakness of the government, if it can deserve the name, that the Tories openly profess their sentiments in favor of the enemy and live unpunished. Letter of William Tudor, Washington's chief legal officer, to John Adams. I was stuck on the back steps with a pile of dull knives and a whetstone. It was a dreary job. First, spit on the stone. Next, hold the knife at the proper angle and circle it against the stone. 10 to the left, 10 to the right, until the blade was sharp enough to slice through a joint of beef like it was warm butter. As I sharpened, I imagined using the knife to cut through the ropes that tied us to New York. I'd slice through the ocean, and Ruth and me would walk on the sand all the way home. 10 circles to the left. Ruth was above stairs, standing by whilst Madam prepared herself for company. The master was locked in his library. Becky was somewhere in the crowd watching General Washington parade down Broadway with 5 regiments of soldiers. The sounds of beating drums and whistling fifes and the cries of huzzah, huzzah, blew toward me over the rooftops. I pushed everything out of my mind, save my task. 10 circles to the right. Becky came back from the parade an hour later, overflowing with stories. She nattered on about the spectacle whilst assembling the tea things for Madam and Lady Seymour, who had come again to call. I pretended to listen. Truth be told, I didn't notice when she left carrying the tray. 10 circles to the left, 10 circles to the righty, all make the blade sharp and mighty. 10 circles to the left,
10 to the right. Becky called for me twice before I heard her proper. Her voice was high and tight.
I said to hurry. You want to get me put out on the street? Madam wants you in the parlor.
The knife nearly slipped from my hands. Is it Ruth?
No, the Lady Seymour wants to see you, and the master just arrived with gentlemen friends all calling for food and drink. Hurry.
I washed up in the cold water bucket, quickly pinned on a clean apron, checked my kerchief was on proper, and followed Becky to the parlor. She rapped lightly on the door and pushed it open.
The new girl, ma'am,
she said, setting a plate of fresh-baked strawberry tarts on the table.
Show her in, madam said.
Becky waved at me to enter. Madam and an older woman sat at the table, but my eyes were drawn behind them to my sister. Dressed up as Madam's pretty pet in a bleached linen shift, a navy blue brocade short gown, and a full skirt patterned with lilacs. When she saw me, she clenched her hands together and bit her lower lip. Her eyes were red and swollen with crying. My belly went funny and my mind raced. Why had she been crying? Was she sick? Scared? Did Madam hurt her? Becky poked me gently in the back. This was not the time for questions. I quickly dropped into a curtsy, bowing my head. When I stood up, the older woman, the lady aunt with all the money, gave me a shadow of a smile. She was smaller than Madam and wore a silk gown the color of a mourning dove and gray lace gloves. Her hair was curled high and powdered snow white. A necklace set with black stone shone from her neck. There were deep lines at the corners of her eyes and around her mouth, but I couldn't tell if they were from laughing or from crying. She turned in her chair and looked at Ruth, then back at me.
And these two girls are the sisters?
She asked. Madam reached for a tart.
That's what the man said.
The older woman sipped her tea.
What is your name, girl?
She asked me.
Isabel, ma'am, I said. Isabel Finch.
Ridiculous name, Madam said. She opened her fan and waved it in front of her face.
You are called Sal Lockton now. It's more suitable.
I forced myself to breathe in slow and regular instead of telling her that my name was not her affair.
Yes, ma'am.
She glanced at my feet.
And you must wear your shoes. This is a house, not a barn.
Ruth stepped out of her corner.
Isabel?
Madam snapped the fan shut and wrapped it against the edge of the table, startling us all.
What did I tell you about silence? She said roughly.
Ruth raised one shaking finger to her mouth and said, shh.
Precisely.
Madam set the fan in her lap and reached for a piece of sugar with silver tongs. When she plopped it in the cup, the tea overflowed into the saucer. Ruth stood there like a carved statue, her finger still held to her lips. I took another breath, slower than the first, and tried not to think on the newly sharpened knives on the kitchen steps. Lady Seymour curled her fingers around the teacup, her gaze marking first Madam, then Ruth, then me. She said nothing.
Would you like Sal to serve you and Lady Seymour while I wait on the gentleman?
Becky asked.
Absolutely not. Show her the library and make sure the men are fed, and bring fresh tea. This has already gone cold.
We curtsied and left the parlor. Ruth's sad eyes followed me to the door. 10 circles to the left, 10 circles to the righty, all make the blades sharp and mighty. Back in the kitchen, Becky took a large silver tray off a high shelf in the pantry.
Hold this.
She loaded the tray with plates of cold sliced tongue, cheddar cheese, brown bread, and a bowl of pickles. I could not stop thinking about the way Ruth had jumped when Madam shouted, nor the tears in her eyes. Becky took down a second tray and set upon it 4 goblets, 2 bottles of claret wine, and a crock of mustard. She swung the kettle back over the fire to heat up more water, picked up the tray with the wine, and said,
"Hop to."
I followed her to the front of the house.
But what about my shoes?
The master won't notice long as he gets his grub. Becky balanced the edge of the tray on her hip and knocked on the door on the right side of the front hall. When a deep voice answered, she opened it.
Lockton looked up as we entered. "Oh, good, sustenance," he said, pushing aside a stack of newspapers to clear off the desk. The room was the same size and shape as the parlor, but two of the walls had bookcases built into them. A large painting of horses jumping over a high hedge hung on the third wall. A thin layer of dust lay over everything. The front windows were open, bringing in fresh air and noise from the street. Carts rolling over the cobblestones and church bells in the distance mingled with the voices of the four men who sat around the enormous desk. One man looked poorer than the others. The cuffs of his coat were frayed and his hands were stained with ink. Next to him sat a man with suspicious gray eyes and a liver-color coat with a double row of gold buttons fastened over a large pudding belly. The third man wore something on his head that looked more like a dead possum than a wig, but his coat was crisp and new, and the buckles on his shoes gleamed. The fourth was Master Lockton, looking like a cat who had just swallowed the last bite of a juicy mouse. Becky set her tray on a sideboard. I held mine as she poured the wine and served the gentleman. Then she had me hold the food tray so that she could serve the tongue and cheese. Talk halted as the men started in on their meal.
"Becky!"
Madam called from across the hall. "Go see to her," Lockton told Becky. "The girl can stay here. Does she know where the wine is?" "Yes, sir," I said. Becky and Lockton both stared at me. I had spoken out of turn. My job was to be silent and follow orders. Ruth had already learned that. "Shh." "Keep the wine flowing and the plates full," Lockton said. "My friends eat more at my table than their own." As Becky left, Gold Buttons drained his wine, then raised his goblet. I hurried to pour him another and topped off the drinks of the other men. Lockton gave me a curt nod when I was finished. "Stand over there," he said, pointing to the corner where the two bookshelves met each other. I gave a wordless curtsy and took my place. The men dove back into their conversation. "Who has been arrested because of the oath?" demanded Lockton. "Fools unschooled in the art of fence-sitting," said Gold Buttons.
"Plank-walking, you mean?"
said Inkstained. Shabby Wig leaned forward and pointed his finger at Inkstained.
"Don't you turn the coward on us, not when we're this close."
"Close?" argued Inkstained. "Do you see His Majesty's ships in the harbor? I don't. I might argue that England has fled and the rebel traitors have won." "Lower your voices," Lockton said with a scowl. He closed the windows with a loud bang, then returned to his seat. "His Majesty's ships are very close, closer than you know. This rebellion will be smashed like glass under a heavy boot, and the king will be very grateful for our assistance." The mention of the king caught my ear. I studied the wide boards on the floor and listened with care. Gold Buttons popped a piece of cheese into his mouth and talked as he chewed.
"I sincerely hope you speak the truth, Elihu. These rebel committees are multiplying faster than rabbits in the spring. They've just about ground business to a halt."
"Have they interfered with you directly?" Lockton asked.
"Every waking moment," Goldbutton said. "The latest bit of nonsense is a committee to detect conspiracies. They've sent the hounds after us, old friend."
"Have you written to Parliament? They need the specifics of our difficulties."
"Parliament is as far away as the moon," complained Inkstained.
As the other men argued about Parliament and letters of protest and counter-letters and counter-counter-letters, Shabbywig stabbed at the last pieces of tongue on his plate and shoved them into his mouth. He turned in his seat to look at me, held up his plate, and grunted. If I had ever done such a thing, Mama would have switched my behind for having the manners of a pig. Even Miss Mary Finch had asked with a please and a thank you when Mama served her dinner. This is New York, I reminded myself as I crossed the room and took the plate from his hand. The rules are different. I loaded his plate down with the last slices of tongue and set it in front of him before retreating to my corner. Everything is different. My belly growled and grumbled in his cage. The smell of the tongue and mustard and the cheese filled the room and made my mouth water. I had eaten a bowl of corn mush at sunrise and only dumplings at midday.
To distract the beast in my gullet, I tried to read the names of the books on the shelves without turning my head. My eyes were as starved for words as the rest of me was for dinner. It was hard to read from the side like that. I wanted to pull down a book, open it proper, and gobble up page after page. I wanted to stare into the faces of these men and demand they take me home. I wanted to jump on the horse in the painting and fly over the hills. Most of all, I wanted to grab my sister by the hand and run as fast as we could until the cobblestones disappeared and there was dirt under our feet again.
"Girl," Lockton said, "bring us more bread, sliced thin, and some of Becky's apricot jam. I've missed the taste of that."
I curtsied and hurried out of the room, leaving the door open a crack so I could easily open it when I came back with my hands full. Across the hall came the quiet conversation of Madam and Lady Seymour. I paused but heard no mention of Ruth.
"Shh."
There was fresh bread on the kitchen table, but it took a piece of time to find the crock of jam. I used one of my sharp knives to slice the loaf, set out the slices on a clean plate, and put the plate and jam on a tray. It was taking me too long to finish a simple chore. I feared the master would be angry with me, and I was angry at myself for being afraid. I was just about to push open the library door with my foot when the master said,
"Compliments of His Majesty, gentlemen. There's enough money here to bribe half of the rebel army."
I stopped and peered through the crack. Madam's linen chest, the one that she had fussed about when we arrived, was in the middle of the library floor, the top thrown open. Underskirts and shifts were heaped on the floor beside it. Lockton reached into the chest and pulled out two handfuls of paper currency.
"Huzzah!" said Inkstained, as Gold Buttons let out a low whistle.
"Do you have a man ready?" Lockton asked.
"Two," Shabby Wig answered. "One will operate out of Corby's Tavern, the other from the Highlander."
"Good." Lockton crossed back to his desk.
I could no longer see him, but his words were clear.
"Every man willing to switch sides is to be paid 5 guineas and 200 acres of land, if he have a wife, an additional 100 acres. Each child of his blood garners another 50. "Makes me want to marry the next lady I clap eyes on," Gold Button said.
Lockton chuckled.
I gave the door a little push and it swung open.
"Sir?"
I asked in a hushed tone.
"Enter," Lockton said.
I walked in. The other men did not look my way. I was invisible to them until they needed something.
"Jam," he said with a smile. "Put it right here."
I placed the tray in front of him and took my place again in the corner. The men spread the jam on the bread and drank their wine, discussing politics and war and armies over the stacks of money on my master's desk. The smell of apricots filled the warm room. It put me in mind of the orchards down the road from Miss Mary's place. I kept my face still as a plaster mask, but inside my brain pan, thoughts chased round and round. By the time the men rose to leave, I knew what I had to do.
Chapter 10. Thursday, June 6, 1776. The people of New York. Why the people are magnificent. In their carriages, which are numerous. In their house furniture, which is fine. In their pride and conceit, which are inimitable. In their profaneness, which is intolerable. In the want of principle, which is prevalent. And in their Toryism, which is insufferable. Letter from Patriot Colonel Henry Knox to his wife, Lucy.
Lady Seymour was the first to leave, followed soon after by the gentleman in the library. Lockton and Madam retired upstairs, releasing Ruth for the evening and leaving me with the cleaning up. For supper, we ate the remainders from the plates of Inkstained and Gold Buttons, cold tongue and brown bread. Ruth ate 3 bites, then laid her head down on the table. When Becky left for the night, I held my sister's hand and walked her down the steep stairs. Our bed was a thin mattress, stuffed with old corn husk in front of the potato bin. I helped her out of her skirt and removed my own. Just before I blew out the candle, I asked, Why were you crying in the parlor today before Becky and me came in? Did Madam hurt you?
Her eyes puddled with tears, and she shook her head from side to side.
No fooling?
Did you play or fuss? Was Madam angry with you? Did she hit you?
She sniffed and wiped her nose on the sleeves of her shift.
Shh, she said again. That wretched woman beat Ruth. I just knew it. She would beat Ruth into total silence if I let her. I kissed her tears and we knelt to pray.
When we finally lay down, my fingers felt along the edge of the blanket, looking for the rip that Mama had sewed up with tiny feather stitches. She wouldn't let anyone hurt her children.
Where's my baby? Ruth muttered, half asleep.
She asked this every night.
That bad man stole your doll, baby, I reminded her.
The skinny one who stole us. He took everything.
Everything?
I hugged her close. Almost everything. But I'll get it back. Don't worry. Just go to sleep.
I can't sleep without my baby.
There was a stubborn note in her voice. I'll make you another doll, I promise, but not tonight.
Want me to sing to you?
I didn't wait for an answer, but started in on an island lullaby that Mama had loved. Ruth lay quiet, her breath steady and slow. By the time the song was over, she was fast asleep. I waited a full hour until the clock struck 11, then slipped out from under the blanket and put my skirt back on. I did not stuff my feet into my shoes. I'd be faster and quieter without them. I climbed up the cellar stairs, freezing with every groan of the old wood. If Madam or Lockton come across me, I'll say I'm on my way to the privy. They couldn't be angry about that. A body must follow the call of nature, even in the dead of the night. The kitchen was so dark, I walked slowly, my hands feeling in front of me so I wouldn't bump into the table or knock over a pitcher on the sideboard. I paused at the back door. The sound of Lockton snoring came from above, like faraway thunder. I'm on my way to the privy, I reminded myself. No harm in that. I carefully opened the door and stepped outside. The night air was crisp and smelled faintly of salt. I tiptoed down the back steps and flew past the privy and around the side of the house to the gate, which hid in shadows. My heart pounded so loud I felt sure it would wake the entire street. I had only to open the gate latch and step out. My hand would not move. If I opened the gate, I would be a criminal. Slaves were not allowed out after sunset without a pass from a master. Anyone who caught me could take me to the jail. If I opened the gate, a judge could order me flogged. If I opened the gate, there was no telling what punishment Madam would demand. If I opened the gate, I might die of fright. I leaned my head against the gate. I could not open the gate. But I had to open the gate. This house was not a safe place. I had to get us out. But there was no way to get out, no way to run away off an island, no way to run with a little girl. The secret of Madam's linen chest was the only key I held. Watch over me, Mama. I opened the latch, slipped out the gate, and ran. I thought it would be easy. I would run straight to the shed behind Bellingham's house, tap on Corzine's window, tell him the news, and hurry home. It was nighttime after all, and folks would be asleep. Not in New York. Not in a city occupied by the Continental Army. At the end of the block, there were soldiers on watch in front of City Hall. A dozen or so men standing around a campfire, with more dozing on the ground. One man was trying to read a letter by the firelight. Another was roasting a small piece of meat at the end of a stick. Their guns were close to hand. I crept as close as I dared, but there was no way to sneak past them. I swallowed hard and turned around to head east, away from the firelight. The next corner was dark and lonesome. I turned south, then west again, then was forced north for 3 blocks by loud soldiers spilling out of taverns. The crowded buildings confuddled me. I tried to be brave like Mama or Queen Esther in the Bible. But I just knew there were hobgoblins walking in the dark, looking to steal the breath from a girl's body. I hid when I heard voices and when a horseman galloped down the middle of the street. The horse's hooves sparked off the cobblestones and sounded like a hammer striking a forge. I chased up and down streets and alleys, sticking to the shadows and shying away from the flickering street lamps. I ran. Finally, the street emptied out onto a wharf. I had reached one of the two rivers that sheltered New York Island, but I couldn't tell if I was looking at the East River or the North. I ventured out farther into the street. Relaxed men told loud jokes to each other on the waterfront. A tin whistle played and a small dog yipped. The mast of ships grew thicker to my right. That was my heading. The shapes of the buildings and the outline of the wharf soon became familiar. There was the dock the Hartshorn had tied to, and there was Bellingham's building. I snuck down the alley to the shed window that Corzine described. This was the end of my quest. I took a deep breath, said a prayer, and rapped on the glass. Nothing happened. I started to rap again, then stopped. What if this is the wrong window? The wrong house? What if the person within thinks me a thief in the night or a murderess? What if... Country? A puzzled voice called to me from the shadows of the back end of a tavern, a few buildings down. Every window in the tavern was lit up, and the air loud with the angry shouts of men deep in argument. Are you speaking to me? I said, trying to keep my voice from shaking. What are you doing here? Corzine stepped out of the shadows and motioned for me to join him. I dashed toward him, keeping to the edge of the tavern candlelight. I have news. Of Lockton? And more. I quickly told him everything I had seen and heard. Is the money still there? He finally asked. A portion, I said. The gentleman took some with them, but Lockton placed the rest back in the chest. Then I was sent to fetch more wine. The chest was gone by my return. He nodded gravely. Will this be enough to send us home? I asked. Can they get us on the ship tomorrow? I can have Ruth at the docks by sunup. He raised both of his hands. Go home and sleep. I'll take your news to Master Bellingham. I expect the committee will visit Lockton tomorrow. Whatever you do, don't let on that you were the informant. Why not, I ask. How else can I claim what's mine? The colonel will know who you are and how to find you. Until you hear from him, you're just the new Lockton girl. But not for long, I said, trying to sound braver than I felt. Not for long, he agreed. Go home now. I hesitated. I don't know how. I got lost coming here. He chuckled softly. It's easy enough once you know the way. Gave me the directions. Thank you, I said, picking up my skirts. Thank you for everything. Go quick. When I was halfway up the alley, he called after me. Hold there, country. What? Well done.
Chapter 11. Friday, June 7th, 1776. There is nothing more necessary than good intelligence to frustrate a designing enemy, and nothing requires greater pains to obtain. Letter of George Washington to Robert Morris. It felt like Becky shook me awake the moment I fell asleep.
Make haste, girl, she hissed. You didn't start the fire. Why are you still abed?
Haste was the word of the day. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't catch up. It did not help that Madam was in a mood.
Girl, she said to me as I prepared to sweep the kitchen floor. The bedding needs to be aired.
Yes, ma'am. I set the broom back in its place and went upstairs where I stripped off the bedding, carried it outside, and pegged it to the line. Just as I finished, Madam opened the back door.
Why are you dawdling so? She yelled. The floor in here is filthy, and the banister needs to be polished. And I told you to wear your shoes in my house.
After I squeezed my feet into those small, dreadful shoes,
It was back to the sweeping and then the polishing of the banister with soft rags and beeswax scented with lemon. When I made it halfway up the stairs, Madam yelled at me for airing the bed linen on a day that threatened rain. At least she did not call for Ruth's company. Becky had set my sister to scrubbing the back steps. Ruth hummed so loudly, it put me in mind of a swarm of bees and clover. As I gathered in the sheets, I watched the gate, waiting for the rebels to arrive to arrest the Locktons and reward me with our liberty. We would be given proper cabins on the ship, I was sure of it. No more riding in the hold with barrels of salt cod. Ruth and me would have a cabin fit for ladies, with bunks and blankets and pillows and 3 meals every day. Yes, indeed, that was my future.
"Aren't you done yet?" Becky yelled from the back door. "We have to prepare the drawing room."
I shook away my daydreams. The drawing room on the second floor wasn't a room where folks sat with paints and colored chalk to draw pictures like I figured. It was another parlor, 3 times the size of the one downstairs. We removed the sheets covering the furniture. 12 chairs with needlework seats were scattered around the room, organized around tables with delicate legs. A low settee stood in front of the fireplace, and a mirror framed in mahogany hung above the mantel, flanked by oil lamps fastened to the walls. "Why this room has to be prepared is beyond me," Becky muttered as we folded the sheets together. "No staff to speak of, the larder half empty, the city getting ready to explode, and she wants this turned out and polished. Of all the foolish..."
A loud beating on the front door interrupted her.
"Dash it all," Becky exclaimed as she clattered down the stairs. "Keep folding," she called to me.
Not for love nor money. I peered out a front window. The group of men clustered on the front steps did not look like angels, but they could have been in disguise. 4 wore the coats, breeches, powdered wigs, and hats of merchants. 1 had papers tucked under his arm. 6 soldiers stood behind them, all wearing uniforms, but carrying long metal bars instead of guns. Becky opened the door, and the men filed inside. I stepped out into the hall and peered down the stairs. The man with the papers under his arm had removed his hat. It was Master Bellingham. My heart sang.
A door slammed overhead as Madam flew out of her chamber.
"What is the meaning of this?"
I pressed myself against the wall so she could rush by me, then followed her down the stairs. The soldiers had split into 2 groups. Half went into the front parlor, and the other half into Lockton's library. Both groups set to remove the windows, prying them out of their casings with the long bars.
"What are you doing to my windows?" Madam demanded.
Bellingham approached her.
"No need to fret, ma'am. We are all called to make sacrifices."
"Sacrifices?" Master Lockton asked as he hurried in.
"This is thievery. What right have you to destroy my home?"
There was a horrific crash in the parlor as the hooks that held up the heavy draperies flew off the wall and landed on the floor. Plaster dust swirled. Bellingham removed the papers under his arm.
"You surprise me, Elihu," he said. "I thought a patriot such as yourself would welcome the chance to contribute to the army."
Beads of sweat stood at the edge of Lockton's wig.
"How does that pertain to the ripping down of my house, James?"
Bellingham patted Lockton's shoulder.
"We need your lead, friend, for ammunition. Good people throughout the city are donating all the lead they own. The provincial Congress will compensate you, of course, in due time. I've invoices prepared."
Madam frowned.
"How is it possible to turn windows into bullets?" "The counterweights are made of lead, ma'am," Bellingham explained. "And your drapery pulls." "This is an outrage," Lockton fumed. "No, Elihu," Bellingham said. "This is war. Even our churches are making the sacrifice, delivering their bells to be recast as cannon. Surely you do not rate your home above the houses of God."
The soldiers left the library, deposited the lead weights by the front door, and headed up to the second floor, knocking their shoulders against the paintings of the Lockton ancestors that lined the staircase. I wanted to shout that they should search for the money in the linen chest. Instead, I shrank against the wall to let them pass.
"They haven't restored the windows to the frames," protested Lockton. "Where are they going?" Madam asked. "There are plenty of carpenters who will assist with the windows," If you don't feel up to the task yourself, Elihu, Bellingham said.
Sir, shouted a soldier upstairs.
We found it.
Bellingham dropped his manners and bounded up the stairs, two at a time. Madam and Lockton followed close on his heels. I trailed behind. The bedchamber was a large room, made small by the four-poster canopy bed that sat as high as a carriage, two massive armoires, and a half-dozen men with red faces. Madam had once again set herself on her walnut linen chest, which sat in front of the hearth. Why was it up here?
Of all the insults, of all the assaults on the dignity of a woman, she said to Bellingham, this, sir, is the lowest, the most base. I shall see to it that every leader in every land knows.
Madam,
Bellingham said sternly, if you do not take your person from that chest, I shall order these soldiers to remove you.
You would not dare, she said.
Yes, he would, dear, Lockton said. Please, wife, let these men do their work with no further delay. There is nothing to worry about.
He seemed to hide a message beneath those words, for Madam relaxed some and still with grace.
If you insist, husband, she said. Perhaps you would prefer to go below stairs, Lockton suggested. The girl could heat some wine to calm your nerves.
Madam shook her head.
No, dear, I shall remain by your side.
Bellingham gave the sergeant a quick nod. The man knelt in front of the chest and opened the latch.
Deliverance. They'll arrest them both and reward me mightily. We'll leave this horrid place by sunset.
One corner of Lockton's mouth turned up in a sly smile as a blushing soldier removed the shifts and underskirts. My heart skipped a beat.
Why were dirty linens still in there? Becky gathered all the washing yesterday.
The soldier looked up at Bellingham.
That's all, sir. Clear down to the bottom.
I wanted to shout, the money is underneath the false bottom,
but pressed my lips together. Bellingham knelt and checked for himself, knocking the wooden sides.
Lockton's grin had spread to both sides of his mouth. Would you care to inspect all of our clothing, James? Perhaps you send a man to root through the potatoes and parsnips in the cellar.
He had hidden the money elsewhere. That's why he was at ease. Bellingham rose to his feet and stood with his hands behind him. Would he turn on me? Accuse me of making a false report and expose me to the Locktons?
No.
He searched through his papers until he pulled out one that he handed to Lockton.
You are summoned to the New York Provincial Congress for suspicion of aiding the enemy, Elihu. I am placing you under arrest. These soldiers will escort you.
He nodded his head. Two soldiers grabbed Lockton by the elbows. His smile vanished.
Wait, Madam said. You can't arrest him. He's done nothing.
To the contrary, ma'am, Bellingham snapped. He has put the lives of thousands in jeopardy.
The men filed by me without another word. Bellingham kept his face straight ahead, but as he passed by, he cut his eyes at me. They drilled a hole right into my fear of discovery. There was the clatter of boots on the stair treads, then boots on the marble steps outside, and then the crash of the front door slamming. They were gone. Madam stared blankly at the empty doorway.
Ma'am? I asked quietly.
Her eyes turned to me, then she blinked as if she suddenly realized who I was and where she stood.
Don't just stand there, girl. These linens need to be washed. I can't think how Becky missed them. I shall speak to her about her laziness.
And then she fainted.
Chapter 12, Friday, June 7th, 1776. By virtue of the authority vested in us, by certain resolutions of the Congress of the Colony of New York of the 7th day of June, do therefore summon you to appear before us, to show cause, if you have any, why you should be considered as a friend to the American cause. Summons from the New York Provincial Congress to a suspected Tory.
Becky sent me to fetch the Lady Seymour to help Madam get through having her husband arrested like that. The old lady lived two blocks north of Trinity Church, the one with spires that scraped the sky.
It's one of them old Dutch-style houses. Got a red door and a knocker looks like a heart, Becky said. Can't miss it.
The house was not far from City Hall, along a street where soldiers with heavy axes were chopping down the row of tall poplar trees.
Fortifications, a soldier explained to a cart man. To protect against the invasion. Any day now, they say.
The red door made the house easy to find. I walked through a beautiful garden around to the back. Neatly trimmed boxwood hedges created a path lined with young betony plants, lavender, daylilies, and honeysuckle. Mama would have admired the roses. My fingers itched to pluck up the scraggly weeds that were crowding them, but I dared not. I knocked at the back. The door was opened by the whitest girl I'd ever seen. Her skin was pale as water except for two flame-colored spots on her cheeks. Her eyebrows and eyelashes were near invisible, and her eyes a mix of pewter and blue. She wiped her hands on her apron and said something I didn't understand. I've come for the Lady Seymour, I explained. Madam Lockton requires a presence. She frowned.
Wat voor u?
What did you say? I asked.
In ogenblik, alstublieft,
she said before she closed the door in my face.
What was an ogenblik?
New York was stranger every passing day. I knocked again, but there was no answer. I was about to walk home when I heard Lady Seymour's voice through an open window. A moment later, the door opened, and she stood there in the kitchen. I curtsied proper-like.
Pardon, ma'am, but they've arrested the master. Madam is poorly.
She nodded. They've been hunting loyalists all day. I told Anne it would come to this.
Come inside, child. Isabel, is it not?
The kitchen was larger than the Locktons, with a tiled hearth and copper pots hanging on the wall. A smoke-colored cat curled itself around my ankles, its tail in the shape of a question mark.
Please sit down. You must be hungry.
I perched on the edge of a chair. Lady Seymour poured me a mug of fresh milk. My surprise at having a proper lady do so must have shown on my face.
You could use some building up, she said as she pushed a plate of molasses cookies to me. Eat and tell me everything.
She turned to her servant, who stood by the hearth.
Will je alsjeblieft effen de meubels afstuffen?
The strange girl bowed once and left the room, the pale pink ribbons from the back of her cap trailing behind her.
She speaks only Dutch, Lady Seymour explained, and shows no inclination to learn English, I'm afraid.
Now a bite and the events. I chewed the cookie quickly, took a sip of milk, and recounted near everything, though I neglected to mention my role as the household spy. She listened carefully as I spoke and asked plenty of questions.
Did Elihu say anything to the men who arrested him? Did he give them any names?
Not my hearing, ma'am. She sat back in her chair. He's in no danger so long as he stays silent. She broke off a piece of cookie, popped it into her mouth, and chewed.
I imagine Anne is in a lather.
Yes, ma'am, I said carefully. She told Becky to pack the trunks for Charleston. Lady Seymour shook her head.
I don't blame her, but fleeing would ensure that the rebels would take everything.
Yes, ma'am, I mumbled. I took an overly large bite of the cookie, certain she would send me back straight away. She tapped her forefinger on the table as she pondered, her rings flashing in the light.
Right, she said firmly, having come to a decision. I will write a note for you to take to the lawyer's office before you go home, and another for Anne, telling her that Elihu will be soon set free.
The Dutch girl came back in the kitchen and said something I could not make out at all. Lady Seymour rose from her chair and motioned for me to stay seated.
Finish those cookies, please, and drink a second glass of milk. You can't run errands for me unless properly nourished.
Chapter 13, Saturday, June the 8th, through Friday, June 21st, 1776. I desire you would remember the ladies, and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands,
Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. That your sex are naturally tyrannical is a truth so thoroughly established as to admit of no dispute. But such of you as wish to be happy willingly give up the harsh title of master for the more tender and endearing one of friend. Letter of Abigail Adams to her husband, John. The front door opened the next morning as I walked down the stairs carrying Madam's chamber pot. It was Master Lockton, back from being arrested. His clothing was rumpled, and he looked as if he had not slept. He paused when he saw me.
Tell Becky I require strong coffee and food. Where is your mistress, and what is she doing?
Above, sir. I gripped the handle of the chamber pot tightly. Packing.
He stormed past me, bellowing for his wife. As I dumped and washed out the chamber pot, I gave thanks. 'Twas clear he did not think me a spy. When I went back inside, there came a ruckus and much shouting from the second floor. I joined Ruth and Becky at the foot of the staircase, the three of us listening with big ears as Lockton and Madam shouted at each other.
"Shh," Ruth said, putting her finger to her lips. "That's right, little one," said Becky. "They don't pipe down soon. The whole neighborhood will turn out to watch."
Crash!
"Bet you that was the wash pitcher," she said.
Crash!
"And the basin," she added. "Do they often fight like this?" I asked.
"Often enough," Becky said.
She stopped as Madam cried out in pain. "The master likes to be obeyed. He's not happy she wants to head for Charleston, and she don't want to stay here."
Lockton lowered his voice some, but he was still angry and scolding.
"Should we do something?" I asked. "Perhaps Lady Seymour could calm him."
Becky shook her head.
"'Twould fire him up even more. Best not to discuss these things."
Ruth stuck her thumb in her mouth. Once the fighting had ended, and the master had been served his meal, I took a cool compress and a mug of cold ale up to Madam. As she applied the compress to her swollen, split lip, she scolded me for not scraping candle wax that had dripped on the floor.
"It caused me to fall," she said. "Do you see what your clumsiness has cost me?"
We both knew it was a lie. There was no wax on the floor. A few drops of blood stained the edge of the carpet.
"What do you have to say for yourself?" she asked.
I didn't like picking up the blame and carrying it, but I had no choice. I bowed my head. "I beg forgiveness, ma'am, and promise it will not happen again."
She removed the compress and winced.
"It had better not."
In the weeks that followed, the master had me serve him whenever his companions visited. I listened closely to their conversating, but they blew only hot air, complaining about the Congress and the weather and the effect of war on business. I was relieved to hear that the printer, ink-stained, had fled the city with his wife and children. Lockton was certain that he had told the rebels about the money and the plan to bribe the American troops. My secret was safe. Becky brought back peas, greens, and gossip from the marketplace. The British fleet was in the harbor. No, the fleet had sailed for Jamaica. No, the Congress had negotiated a peace. No, the British planned to kill us all while we slept. Gossip is the foul smell from the devil's backside. That's what Mama always said. I tried to ignore the wild stories and stay alert for something, anything, I might use to secure our freedom. Becky had been quite happy to give me the chore of hiking up to the tea water pump every day. After my first few visits, it became the favorite part of my day. The pump was set in a little shed at the edge of the common, a big gathering place ringed by army barracks, the poorhouse, and the jail. There were trees and fields to the north of the common and the burying place for Africans. The air was cleaner up there, easier to breathe. A week after Lockton returned home, Corzine stood with me in the line of servants waiting for water. I was desperate to ask him questions, but knew they had to wait until we were alone. When my turn came, I handed my buckets to the ancient slave who worked the pump handle, a man old as dirt, with stone gray hair, and skin the color of the night sky. He carried a country mark on his face, three straight lines that had been cut into his right cheek when he became a man in Africa. Papa had a mark that looked close to it. It made me feel kin to the old man, and I smiled and curtsied polite whenever I saw him.
"Thank you, Grandfather."
Curzon said to the man as he handed us the full buckets. I was surprised. He's your grandfather? I didn't know that. The old man chuckled softly and reached for the buckets of the girl standing behind me.
I'm the grandfather of everybody and everything.
He pushed down on the handle of the pump and water flowed.
Mind how you go, missy.
Corzin waited until we were two blocks down Queen Street before he asked me about Lockton's affairs. He traveled to Fairfield in Connecticut 2 days ago and came home late last night, I said. I thought he was on a parole, that he had to stay in New York. Why don't they arrest him? Corzin looked behind us and from side to side before answering. They don't have enough men to follow him, he explained. And his aunt has powerful connections, both here and in England. There must be solid proof before they dare arrest him again. Should you ever come in possession of letters sent to him, or maps, or if I find the king hanging in our pantry? I interrupted.
The Congress would give you a medal for that, he said with a grin.
I would rather have passage home on a fast ship. You don't want to sail anywhere, not now, he said, doffing his hat and bowing to three officers passing on horseback. I likewise bobbed in the direction of the gentlemen and waited for them to draw out of earshot before speaking again.
Why not?
The royal fleet is fast approaching and is eager for battle and spoils. If you sailed now, you'd likely be captured and sold to the islands.
Idle gossip and pipe smoke, I said.
You hear it on every street corner. It's a wonder we don't all choke to death on it.
Where you see smoke, you find fire, country. Don't worry. The day of our liberty will soon dawn. This country is going to be free, and you and me with it.
For a boy with a little head, you sure do have big dreams. I just want what's owed me.
You need to be patient, he said with a frown. The army has bigger fish to fry than you and your sister.
And I have bigger fish to fry than your army, I said with a whole lot more confidence than I truly felt.
The sun set later and later in those weeks. The extra light was welcome and put to good use. I aired out our pallet and blanket and tidied our cellar corner. The potato bin was near empty, and Ruth asked to play in it as if it was a little house. I would not let her. Instead, I made her a corn husk doll, painting a face on it with pokeberry juice and fashioning a gown for it with a piece of cambric from Becky's scrap bag. One night, feeling out of sorts and reckless, I crept up the stairs. It was after midnight, and Lockton and his wife slept heavily. I snuck into the library and took a book from the shelves, a story called Robinson Crusoe by Mr. Defoe. I sat by the glowing coals in the kitchen hearth and read until I could hold my eyes open no longer. When the fat moon rose the next night, I planted the mystery seeds I had taken from Mama's jar. I did not know what they would grow into, but planting them deep in the cool dirt was a comfort. Thunder boomed in the distance as a summer storm approached. Oh, I checked the cows, I thought. Storms made them nervous. More thunder rolled, and then a third wave. Fool, I scolded myself. The cows were in our old life, not this one. The moon climbed higher, and the air returned to stillness and waiting. I took myself to bed and did not dream.
Chapter 14. Saturday, June 22nd, 1776. Life very uncertain. Seeming danger scattered thick around us, plots against the military, and it is whispered against the Senate. Let us prepare for the worst. We can die here but once. May all our business, all our purposes and pursuits tend to fit us for that important event. Letter of Congressional Delegate Abraham Clark to Elias Dayton.
The next day, I carried a basket of eels from the fish market to Wall Street, thinking only of hot eel pie for supper. I had not eaten eel pie since Mama died, Miss Mary Finch not being fond of it. But Master Lockton enjoyed the dish, so fat eels weighed down my basket. I fervently hoped Becky would chop off their heads and strip off their skins. It made me go all jumbly in the belly to chop off heads. I entered the kitchen and set the basket on the table. Ruth hummed quietly to herself, shelling peas into a large wooden bowl, and Becky chopped kale. Madam walked in from the front hall. her hair half fallen out of her cap, and stains of sweat under the arms of her dress. She crossed the room, peered out the back door, crossed her arms over her chest, and tapped her foot with impatience, then disappeared into the next room. "I require you, girl," she said. Becky looked at me, eyes